So it was yesterday that we were actually speaking at some length with one of Jeff Anderson's colleagues about this settlement that the Catholic Church has reached with Doe One, John Doe One, the one of the victims of sexual abuse by the priests in the Catholic Church in this area. And we had scheduled today Jennifer Hasselberger to come by, so the timing seems to be pretty fortuitous. She was the canonical advisor and was, the Chancellor for Canonical Affairs for the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis for 5 years, ending in 2013. Jennifer, we appreciate your coming on the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
When something like that happens, what was your reaction yesterday to the news? Did you hear about it like the rest of us did, or did you know that there was going to be a settlement in the offing?
Well, I primarily heard about it because I was present at the news conference. I had been invited to attend, and so that's where I learned the details.
What was your reaction to the settlement?
I said yesterday that I think it's a tremendous victory for people who are concerned about the safety of children in the archdiocese, and I continue to feel that way. At the same time, it's a legal settlement in one particular case, and so I think having had time to reflect on the provisions of the settlement, there's still some issues that we need to work on before we can really say that we're past this crisis.
For instance?
Well, what I've done based on my thinking is I've come up with four things that I need to see, that I need to see done in order to really feel like we've moved beyond this, that things have really changed and we truly are in the new era that everybody was speaking about yesterday. And the first of those is a change in leadership in the Archdiocese.
John Neinstedt has to go?
I think most people have come to that conclusion. Even those who are the most strong partisans of him, I think, have come to a position where they're questioning his ability to lead us forward.
12 tenured members of the faculty at St. Thomas wrote a letter to that effect, but they stopped shy of asking for his resignation because they said, we know he won't. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I think for Catholics, it's always important for us to acknowledge the fact that we're not the decision makers in those particular situations. And so what I guess I would say is there needs to be a leadership change, whether that happens from him resigning or by, you know, outside forces intervening. That isn't for me to say. That's for others to decide. But
yeah, but I think a lot of people, be it a football team, a company, or a church, conclude that you can't have real change unless you have change at the top.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I mean, probably even a little willing to go a little bit farther. You know, I think it's time for Bishop Pache to probably take a medical retirement. I think if Bishop Cousins' future ecclesiastical ministry is going to be salvaged, then it's probably time to move him to another archdiocese where he can serve as an auxiliary under a bishop who's capable of mentoring him and showing him what authentic and honest leadership is.
Why? Why do you say that about these other two individuals? Because they knew about what was going on all along?
Well, Bishop Cousins wasn't involved in the same sense, but I think, I think the capacity of Bishop Pache and Archbishop Neinstedt to exercise ecclesiastical ministry in this archdiocese in this situation has been called into question.
Am I correct? You said that if you'd known that they were going to settle, your testimony, your affidavit would have been different. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely.
Why do you say that?
Well, because in writing my affidavit, which is already incredibly long for an affidavit.
It's 107 pages, right?
And then there were documents that were attached. I was fulfilling a specific purpose, but doing it always with the expectation that I would be called on to testify at trial. That hasn't happened, and so
there's no trial.
Happen.
You're not getting a chance to testify. What would you have wanted to say on the stand that you didn't in this document?
Oh, well, there's
and understand that I don't have all day.
Yeah, of course. These are there's a number of issues. I think for every example I give, I could have given 15 more
of cases of neglect or abuse
and mismanagement by the archdiocese.
You know, they're all kind of peels from the same onion, aren't they? I was rereading the affidavit last night and again today, and it seems to me like you have abuse, and then you have people who maybe knew about it but didn't do enough, and then you had people that were looking away, and all of those are sort of from the same tree, aren't they? And it's sad, it's tragic to see not just the abuse, which sometimes we think of as a physical act, but an institution that was negligent, that wasn't tending to what had to happen.
Absolutely.
And you say there are more examples of that. Do you mean of specific instances of priest to juvenile contact, or do you mean just negligence, people not interested in uncovering the truth?
I think both. And that's why the second point that I think needs to be addressed before I'm convinced that we've actually made any progress is that there's a number of priests who still need to be removed from ministry.
Who are still serving in the Archdiocese
now? Who are, yes.
Have they been named in the court proceedings?
They've only released a redacted version of my affidavit.
I noticed there was a lot of names missing there, but I thought maybe those had appeared in previous court documents.
No.
So you know of names that have not yet been made public?
Yes.
And you know of specific acts that haven't been, I guess, made public. I guess we don't have a list of the acts per se, but you know of plenty of instances that you didn't write about in your affidavit.
Well, even in my affidavit, there's a number of them that haven't been made public, again, because of the redaction. But I would have expanded in my testimony.
Well, that kind of takes your breath away.
Which is exactly why I'm saying that while the settlement has, it's done some great things, I think it's done great things in two areas. One, it's going to immensely improve the Archdiocese's response to survivors or victims of abuse. I think that is one very positive thing. I also,
you mean the protocols that they set up?
The protocols, yes, exactly. I also think that the new protocols are going to strengthen the way the church conducts investigations when they learn of criminal acts.
But who's going to do that? Who's going to oversee that?
Apparently, Tim O'Malley will be overseeing it, but it will be turned over to the police, which is where it should have always been.
I'm sorry, who is Tim O'Malley?
He is the new, I think they call him the Director of Safe Environment.
Maybe you don't have an answer to this. Do we have confidence that this person will be cooperative with the police and will be as transparent as needs to be?
I don't think anybody is questioning that. His background is in law enforcement. I don't have any doubts that he's a man of great integrity and capability. My concerns are his ability to do what he needs to do within that environment. And that, I think, again, is relating to the fact that we need a leadership change. And, you know, again, I think the leadership change is even broader than that. One of the strange things for me being at that press conference yesterday was that I was in the back of the room. So I wasn't seeing it through the same lens that people were who saw pictures or watched video on TV. I had a much broader view. And while the people in front of the TV, those faces were all new, if you could actually see everyone assembled, most of the people there on behalf of the Archdiocese were the same people that you find in my affidavit and that I had been working with and against, really, during the 5 years that I served there.
You mean people who weren't cooperating, people who were in the way.
Exactly.
And what do you say about that, the fact that they were there? If I had seen them, what would I have noticed? I mean, what was the point that they were there?
Well, I think it called to mind that scene from The Sound of Music, the movie version, where they do the puppet scene, mm-hmm. and you can see both the people pulling the strings and the puppets themselves. The puppets were all the new faces. The people pulling the strings were all the old ones. If you'll allow me that analogy.
I get it now, but I wonder, too. I have to pause. It's 3:20. Jennifer Hasselberger is here. She was obviously instrumental in the sort of revelation of some of this information for a lot of us. She was a canonical advisor, the Chancellor for Canonical Affairs for the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis for 5 years, but worked there for 10, right? Didn't you start around 2004?
I started in 2004, worked there till 2006, but then I resigned the first time. Almost for similar reasons, although I was in a different position.
I have a couple questions for you, though, about the settlement that was reached and also about why, as you saw this thing unfolding over those 10 years, weren't the police more directly involved more quickly? And you've still got two more points you haven't told us about from your blog about things you think need to happen yet. You said that, in general, you thought that the idea of the protocols, this sort of template for how the church can go forward, was a reasonable settlement between this person and the church. There was also a cash settlement. And when we were talking with one of the attorneys about this yesterday, they said that it would not be disclosed what the amount was. I said, do you worry that casts a pall on the proceeding. Here's the rich church giving money to somebody, and in exchange for that, rather than going to the trial that you would have testified at, and who knows how that would have gone, they've given this person an amount of money, and now the thing is settled. Does that look a little hinky to you or to us?
I think you have to look at the settlement as being something much more broad than just these protocols, and also the monetary settlement. I have always heard, and I believe, that Do Won's concern was never the financial settlement. And his actions suggest that.
I've been told that as well.
They could have settled it early on. What he was really interested in, again, this is what I've been told and what I've come to believe, is in seeing these kind of positive actions to ensure nothing happens to any future children.
Well, if it works for him, then far be it for me to judge. Mm-hmm. But for 10 years, there you were, intimately aware of the accusations and the heel-dragging that was taking place by the church.
Well, not for 10 years. So what happened is I was there for 2 years, from 2004 to 2006. Then I left because I was despairing, really, of the way the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis operated. And I went and I worked in two other dioceses where I was actually able to do quite good work, quite proactive work on these issues. And it was only when there was a leadership change in the Archdiocese, when Archbishop Neinstead was now taking over for Archbishop Flynn, that I decided to come back.
What year was that?
That was 2008.
2008 to 2013, so mm-hmm. for those next five. Why didn't this stuff sprint to the police? Why didn't this stuff get to cops or to county prosecutors sooner?
I guess I continue to wonder about that. There's different things I heard. There's different things that I saw. The Archdiocese had some really weird ideas about responding to some things. For instance, they would often defer to the victims about whether there would be any report, especially when they were adults.
If they didn't want to, then they wouldn't
exactly.
pursue it, which shouldn't be the prerogative of the victim if it's a criminal proceeding.
Well, and to me, I almost felt like we were getting in the situation that used to be an issue with domestic violence cases, you know, where the police would go and, you know, say, well, do you want us to arrest him? As, you know, the husband's glaring, assuming it was the husband, and the four kids are crying. You know, that's an unfair position to put people in, and it's just wrong. But also, you know, they also operated on this principle of lesser punishment if you self-report. And I was always amused by how this kind of came about, because I saw cases where, you know, the letter was on its way to the chancery, and the priest, you know, called and informed us of it right before the mail was delivered, and they still were giving him credit for self-reporting.
You said off the air something about the safety of the church today. You've got family and friends that are. Are you still a member of the Catholic Church? Do you attend services in this area?
Oh, absolutely.
So you're a practicing Catholic, and mm-hmm. you said something to me off the air I want to talk about on the air about your perceived safety of the church, which is a funny kind of concept. But the larger issue is here, how is the church going to change? And are they changing? We've been reading on canonicalconsultation.com. It's Jennifer Hasselberger's blog. You can read there her comments on this story as it unfolds. She's in our studio right now. Mm-hmm. How safe do you think the Catholic Church in the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis is?
I still have concerns. I have concerns because I think there are priests whose, if their behaviors and their characters and their mentality was known, people wouldn't be comfortable.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's, I know the decisions that I would make for the people in my life. And this was always part of the work that I was doing.
Saying the children aren't safe in the presence of some of the men who are attending to them in the Catholic Church in the area?
Yes.
That are currently in parishes?
Yes, I believe.
That are doing day-to-day contact with students, young people, religious education, that sort of thing?
I believe that to be true.
Do you think that that's the extraordinary exception, or are there tens of them out there? I mean, I'm trying to get a grasp on this.
Well, at the time that I was working in the Archdiocese, I think we had 32 men who were being monitored.
And that was a year ago.
And that was up to a year ago. Now, not all of those were involved with children.
What would that mean if they weren't being monitored for interaction with children? Maybe.
Then it was with adults or vulnerable adults. But in addition, there was a number of people that we had identified as needing monitoring who weren't fitting the list. I think in my affidavit I talk about 50. about 50 priests. And do all of those need to be removed? No, I don't think so. But I think there needs to be a reassessment of how the Archdiocese evaluates fitness in ministry.
Well, Jennifer, when we're talking about interaction with children, are we talking about pedophilia? Or are we talking about guys who I don't know exactly what it is that you're talking about, literal sexual interaction or inappropriate touching with young boys?
Well, pedophilia is very limited, of course. So I think what I'd like to say is there are people who there are priests and deacons that my concern is they don't have the ability to maintain the appropriate boundaries with the people that they minister. In some cases, that could lead, as it did in the case of Curtis Wehmeyer, to physical sexual abuse. In other cases, you could have sexualization of children that the children might themselves not be aware of.
What do you mean by that, sexualization of children?
Oh, well, I think the best example that we've seen is, you know, there was the priest that accompanied his it was a parish that had a school and a high school, and the confirmation students, I think it was, went on a retreat, and one of the students woke up in the middle of the night to find this priest rubbing his hands up and down his stomach underneath his shirt. Now, you know, the priest admitted to the church that it was a sexually pleasurable act. He had done it before, so it's a predatory behavior.
So what happens to somebody in that case?
To the victim or to the priest?
To the priest.
Well, in this case, he stepped away from ministry, but only in, I think it was December of 2013.
So he was allowed to continue in his role for a while.
He was in charge of a school.
Are you as flabbergasted by that as I am?
Oh, more so. And this, I guess this is...
Is that a crime, what he was doing, though? I mean, so why didn't you tell the police?
So it happened in another state at an earlier time. And so sometimes you have to deal with those realities. In this particular case, I think it was West Virginia. But also, you know, I think what people need to understand is, for me, what was so difficult is I knew this. And I made concrete decisions about what I knew about this priest for the people in my own life. He was assigned to a parish that was very close to Fort Snelling. And when they first opened Target Field, my nephew and I used to go to the games, but we'd take the light rail, you know, that's what they encouraged everyone to do. And there was one occasion where I had to drop something off at his parish. And we were going to the game that night. So it had been really easy for me to take my nephew, who was, I think, 11 or 12 at the time, stop at the parish, drop off the paperwork, and then, you know, proceed to Fort Snelling and catch the light rail. And I sat there in my office thinking, there is no way. There is just no way I'm taking this 11 or 12-year-old boy and putting him in any proximity to this priest that I know has an admitted sexual attraction to boys of his age. I just wouldn't.
Then what do you say to the people of that parish?
Well, that was always my concern. And this is what...
But what would you do? I mean, but you didn't do anything. I'm not judging you, but I have wondered out loud about your action and inaction. Should you have stood up at the parish, you know, say I object in the middle of a sermon and say, just so you guys know, or put something in the church bulletin? How do you communicate with the parish and what's the appropriate thing to do? In a situation.
Well, I didn't have those options. I mean, I suppose I could have stood outside the parish holding up the signs, but part of what I was dealing with is if I would have done that at that particular parish, that would have been the end of my job, and that meant I wouldn't have been able to be effective at any of the others.
So you felt that it was better to fight this from inside than from outside?
Until I couldn't escape the reality of what was taking place because of that. And that really came to the forefront with the abuse by Father Wehmeyer.
That was the case that tipped you?
I think it was because, you know, again, I was always bringing up these points again and again and again. Making these arguments.
Whom?
Oh, to who wasn't I?
Well, was Archbishop Nienstedt always hearing
aware.
From you? Was he always sorry to see you in a gracing his doorway going, really?
Nobody ever graced his doorway. He didn't speak to people. But certainly, and I think you can see this, that the memos that are coming out as a result of this lawsuit certainly indicate that. Father Laird,
But would they agree that you had a point? They go, we know. You're right.
Oh, no.
So are they denying that the things you're saying were happening were happening?
No, I think I used to tell people I felt like I was the Cassandra of the Chancery. You know, here's this woman prophesying doom, but no one takes her seriously until the Greeks break through the walls of Troy. It was a lot like that. So I would say, you know, this is what's going to happen. Oh, no, he's doing fine. We haven't had any problems.
Of late.
You're overreacting. And then this happens. And, you know, if at that moment, when we learned about the Weymeyer allegations, there had been any movement to say, okay, we've got to stop and rethink this, we would be in a different position. But that wasn't what they decided.
You wrote on your blog about one priest who was so odd that you said, this is the one guy I can't be in a room with alone.
Oh, I didn't say odd. I said creepy.
You did.
And I think that's important because this is somebody whose offenses are directed towards women, although it has occasionally kind of crossed the boundaries into teenage girls.
Excuse me, Jennifer. What is this person doing today?
He's a priest at one of our parishes.
Here in the... Okay, keep going.
Mm-hmm. But knowing his history, knowing what was in his file, knowing what his sexual issues were and how they manifest itself, it was difficult for me to have to go to meetings with him and be the only woman in the room.
Why? Because you thought, were you in fear for your safety or just he was just too damn creepy?
Well, because one of the things that he does or did or his issue is that he has this problem where he can't help himself from mentally undressing the women he sees. And so what it appears that he's doing is staring at parts of your body for long periods of time. But
how do you know that's the mental act that he's doing?
Because it's well documented in the files.
It's been well known he's admitted as much.
Yes.
So then why doesn't the church just say, listen, you're not, whatever you are, you can't be that and be this. So we're now going to, you will no longer be a priest. You'll no longer be an officer of the church. You are fired. Why can't they do that?
Honestly, I don't know that they could. I think, you know, they've acknowledged that he has mental illness, and I think it probably raises to the level that they could not actually laicize him because he's not.
Wait a minute. Doesn't that just make my case that much easier?
Your case. It was my case to begin with.
Isn't this a right-to-work state? Can't you fire? You could fire me for being left-handed in Minnesota.
The Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis has given up their right to be an at-will employer. But beyond that, the relationship with clergy is somewhat different. I think for him, you know, he's probably not well enough for that to be a solution. But that doesn't mean you assign him to a parish.
Tell me a couple of other things that have to happen in the Archdiocese.
In order for the church and the Archdiocese to heal, I think the third point is the Archdiocese needs to give Green and Espel permission to release their report into the investigation in Archbishop Nienstedt. That report needs to be made public.
What does that report detail?
Oh, well, I have an idea of what it details, but nobody really knows.
More abuse.
I think it's concerning behavior on the part of the Archbishop. And my concern...
The current one?
The current Archbishop, yes, Archbishop Nienstedt.
What are you intimating?
I'm not trying to intimate anything.
You'd like to know what's in the report.
I think I have a fairly good sense of what's in the report. I want them to make the report public so that we can take the necessary actions. And what alarms me so much about it is just because, you know, especially after Commonweal published their story about the investigation, how many people who have contacted me who had these experiences with the Archbishop in seminary or when they were newly ordained. I think we have to get to the bottom of that in order for us to be confident about the future crop of priests.
Point number four.
Point number four is I would like to know what the Archdiocese is doing right now to care and support the victims of Father Curtis Weymeyer. They're not included in the settlement. As far as I know, the litigation is ongoing, and my experience with the Archdiocese is that they tend to engage in scorched earth tactics, which is really aimed at, you know, starving the victims to the point that they reach a settlement that's favorable to the Archdiocese. These boys were harmed. We were responsible for that harm. And we need to make sure that they have the ability to care for themselves now and going forward.
Appreciate you coming by our studio today.
Yeah.
I appreciate what you've been writing and commenting on online. Tomorrow you'll talk about what the Catholic Church in general, Rome on down, needs to be thinking about.
Exactly.
I think priests should marry. I think we need to broaden the pool. Do you agree with that?
You know, I think there's many good celibate priests. It's not for everybody, but I don't think that that's necessarily the answer. I'm more concerned with how the church can facilitating whistleblowing from inside, so we don't have to have a situation of people going outside.
Canonicalconsultation.com. Thanks for coming in, Jennifer.
You're welcome. Thank you.